Been done, the wedding industry will have swindled tens of thousands of dollars out of the female's desire to indulge in a few hours of socially acceptable narcissism. The amount spent would have been enough to send their kids to college, or more altruistically, could have been used to buy enough common medicines and immunization shots to save the lives of 250 African children. Later, the couple will fight incessantly over money. Amidst all of this, generally around the 18-month mark of their relationship, a lull is experienced, coinciding with a reduction in the production of certain brain chemicals responsible for the passions and delusions over their partner's above-average adequacy. Behaviors that were previously seen as adorable now seem grating. She begins to henpeck every little action of his that doesn't mesh with her childhood fantasy of marrying Prince Charming. He stops pretending to care about her petty dramas and gossip. In public, his eyes wander to other women, with the penetrating gaze of a predatory carnivore. She reaches out to an old flame on social media. When given as a mere average, reports on the frequency of marital sex are bound to overestimate the number for those long past the bloom of their nuptials. I once queried a friend about his sex life now that he had just celebrated his 10th year of incarceration, his term expressed with a feigned jocularity. He responded, "It was pretty good on the night of our anniversary, and I'll let you know in another 6 months when we do it again." The infrequency of sex among married couples is so common it may be appropriate to ask, is this just human nature? If it is, we would expect to see a similar pattern in the number of times HGs have sex. And there is indeed evidence of some decline in sexual activity in HG societies as couples age. Before the age of 30, Aka tribe members report having sex with their spouses 3.1 times per night. But the sexual activity of couples between the ages of 30 and 45 sees a dramatic drop-off, down to a mere 2.8 times a night. Between the ages of 18 and 45, Aka couples average 7 to 8 acts of coitus per week, the usual pattern being to have sex 3 times a night, take a couple days off to recuperate, and then resume activities. What is the explanation for this insatiable female sexual appetite? They say everything in life has a silver lining. In this case, it's the upside of a lot of dead babies. The precariousness of infant life in HG society spurs women to make full use of their fertile years. Although the goal of procreation takes precedence, sex is not without enjoyment. The Aka women orgasm at least once before sunrise. A Hadza love story. Ostensibly, Oswo's excuse for heading over to the neighboring camp a dozen miles away was to discuss game patterns. That is what he told his friends anyway, though the true reason was the swirling rumors that a young girl of that clan had blossomed into a beautiful 17-year-old woman. At 21, it was time to find a woman to live with, to clean his hut, fetch his water, and comfort him at night. He had spotted the young woman soon after entering the camp. Her smile, her eyes, those plump, perky breasts. He saw that her legs were fit, and her rump curved from hours of unearthing tubers. Signs of fertility abounded. Ishka had noticed him, too, particularly the way he stole furtive glances at her when he thought she wasn't looking. Although she pretended not to be aware of his presence, she made sure to be seen as having fun and giggling with her friends whenever he was in the vicinity. Her friends whispered that he was a great hunter and had already killed 3 baboons. A conversation began. A stroll through the bush, some innocent hand-holding, the removal of thorns from the other's shoulders, and then kisses. He would not be returning to his camp. What is meant by marriage in Hadza society? Is there a big ceremony, lifelong vows, till death do us part affirmations? No. Marriage is a useful term anthropologists use to describe the living arrangements of hunter-gatherer couples. In truth, it simply means that a man and woman will start sleeping in the same hut. Oswo and Ishka will fall madly in love, and their constant lovemaking will result in a beautiful Hadza baby. But if you are expecting a fairy tale, a heartwarming saga of everlasting love and happiness, don't hold your breath. While living with the Hadza, Michael Finkel noted that marriage in hunter-gatherer tribes was not devoid of bickering. It's your turn to fetch the water. Why was the meat not properly cooked? Why are you napping instead of hunting? Women think men are lazy. Men think women nag. In short, the human condition. Years later, Oswo will visit another nearby camp and flirt with a woman there. He'll make love to her. Back home, Ishka will hear of her husband's philandering through the grapevine. When he returns from his trip, he will find that he is no longer welcome in his hut. Not long after, she will take up residence with a new husband. Oswo will feel sad. He did not want his wife to leave him. He just wanted a little action on the side. Think of the marriage advice we commonly hear. Phrases such as, "A good marriage takes hard work." "A good marriage involves lots of sacrifice." Or, as Montagne put it, "A good marriage would be between a blind wife and a deaf husband." Lifelong and exclusive monogamy is not part of Homo sapiens' DNA. If it were, we wouldn't find marriage so difficult. We are best described as serial monogamists who will, if the right opportunity arises, engage in discreet sex with other partners we find attractive. It's how we have done things for millions of years. A study of the Aceh tribe of hunter-gatherers showed that the average woman would have had 10 spouses by the age of 30, and had children with at least 2 of them. How then to use this knowledge to improve relationships in the 21st century? If you're expecting me to offer some ingenious solution to this problem, I'm sorry to disappoint you. This is one of the cases where village life is so radically different from contemporary society that no easy fix presents itself. Many couples stay together in loveless marriages because they have erroneous views about the nature of human romance. It should last forever, and if it's not working, we must be doing something wrong. We should stay together for the sake of the children. I can't stand giving away our fortune to divorce lawyers. None of these were problems for our ancestors. Without any tradition of lifelong marriage, people were expected to switch partners many times over the course of their lives. Since infidelity was so rampant, and everyone in the tribe at best distant relatives, a father could not be sure that the child was actually his. Consequently, paternal investment was very low among our ancestors. Children were nursed by their mothers until they had a certain degree of autonomy, and then were free to run around the village and do as they pleased. There was no need for lawyers and judges to arbitrate custody battles. No wars were fought over who got the house and the fine china collection. The hut they lived in would be knocked down in a month when these nomads moved camp, and the water bucket was easily replaced. Perhaps we should use this knowledge to develop a more realistic approach to human relationships. We should not expect our significant others to love and desire a single partner throughout their lives. They will be attracted to other people, and temptation might get the best of them. Their desires don't mean that we are somehow unworthy. It just means that our partner is human. The Piraha give us an example of an emotionally healthy response to infidelity. Dan Everett once walked into the hut of a couple to see the woman seated and the man lying in her lap. She was smacking him in the head as punishment for spending the night in another woman's arms. He was apologizing and pretending to be more hurt from the smacks than he really was, while she cursed him out and pretended to be angrier than she really was. Their feigned screams of anger and pain were interrupted by bouts of giggling. Psychedelics. I sat high up in a tree in the middle of campus. It was the last day of the school year at university. Coeds passing underneath gazed up to notice 3 laughing freshmen resting 30 feet up on the oak tree's branches. After having exhausted voyeuristic thrills from the vantage of our lofty perch, we climbed down and headed to the campus garden, where we chopped down a few bamboo trees. We slung the bamboo shoots over our shoulders and marched around the brightly colored roses and daffodils bathing in the afternoon sun. My two friends and I had ingested a bag of magic mushrooms. Have you ever wanted to visit Never Never Land for a day? That's how I describe the wonders of a psychedelic trip to the uninitiated. Like the characters in Peter Pan who remain day after day in an everlasting youth, the subjective experience of time under the influence of magic mushrooms crawls to a halt. What in reality is only hours seems an eternity. We may have been simply walking around campus, but to us we were on an epic journey, with every new tree, every open field, every garden a new adventure to be had. The beauty of the world was overwhelming. Had I ever truly immersed myself in the wondrous efflorescence of a flower before? Was the dance of the clouds across the azure sky always this delightful? My friends and I made endless jokes, laughing until our eyes teared up. We also had profound philosophical insights during our altered state of consciousness. Despite the occasional harmless bout of paranoia, we thought we were being stalked by a bald female dwarf. We all agreed that up until this point, the day had been the best of our lives. As the high began to wear off, I separated from my friends and headed back to my dorm room. On my computer screen was an instant message from Katie. With long legs, large breasts, and a model's face, she was the best-looking girl in the freshman class. I'd had a crush on her for a year. Did she feel the same way about me? I intended to find out. I wasn't so experienced dealing with women back then, and had failed to make any serious headway, despite several invitations to her room late at night to study. "Who wants to study at this hour?" I used to ask myself. This time, I had my head screwed on right. Or so I thought. Yes, I would come over to smoke a few bowls to celebrate the end of the school year. I sat on the bed admiring her figure as I inhaled the potent marijuana smoke. I was nervous and excited about the possibility of sleeping with such an exquisite beauty. I gazed into her emerald eyes. I felt my heart palpitate. A quick peek at her cleavage, blood pumping to an obvious organ. Still high from the magic mushrooms, I told her about my adventures as we smoked a second bowl. The marijuana seemed to be enhancing the effects of the shrooms. She was laughing and inching closer. "This is it," I thought. "The time is now." Then, just as I was about to make my move, I noticed something strange. I was floating out of my body. It was time to abort. I awkwardly excused myself and headed back to my dorm room. Now, I'm sure someone watching me would have simply seen a freshman with a strange look on his face scurrying across the quad. But in my subjective experience, I was warping 50 feet at a time through campus until I got to my room. I lay down on my bed as I continued to float out and above my body for the next 3 hours. Meanwhile, the world kept going black and turning into a kaleidoscope whenever I closed my eyes. Evidence that people ingested magic mushrooms dates back to 5000 BCE in northern Algeria. Cultures in Central and South America left behind sculptures of mushroom gods, including Piltzintecutli, the god of the divine mushroom. Spanish explorers wrote of the use of these mushrooms by the Aztecs as early as 1502, when they were served at the coronation of Montezuma II. The Spanish conquerors quickly forbade the use of these potent plants, believing that the mushrooms allowed the natives to communicate with the devil. Their use continued in secret, however, in mountain villages beyond the reach of the invaders, in ceremonies passed on down through the generations. R. Gordon Wasson, who is a vice president of J.P. Morgan, visited one of these villages with his family and a few friends in 1955. They would become the first Caucasians in recorded history to participate in one of these ancient ceremonies. They were led by the shaman Maria Sabina. Wasson would write about his experience in Life magazine, and a horde of Westerners would descend upon this rural village, including the likes of John Lennon, Bob Dylan, and Mick Jagger. Like any other remote place in the world, once the tourists turned up, the indigenous culture and ritual suffered. At the time Wasson ingested the mushrooms, no one knew what it was that made them such powerful conduits of psychedelic experience. Wasson brought the mushroom spores to Albert Hofmann, the inventor of LSD, who isolated the psychoactive chemical and found it to be psilocybin. Today, these mushrooms are cultivated in great quantities all around the world and are in easy reach of your typical college freshman. The profundity of a psychedelic trip is impossible to explain to one who has never tried such substances. Take a large enough dose and you are guaranteed to have the most intense experience of your life. It is not uncommon to feel a changed person afterward, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, depending on the quality of your experience. It is not hyperbole to say that a trip can be so glorious you will think you are in a fairy tale, or if things take a bad turn, one so harrowing you might as well be the character in Edvard Munch's painting, The Scream. These bad trips could largely be avoided if the hallucinogens are taken in the right circumstances, after the right preparation, and with a sage guide, the way Indians have been doing it for thousands of years. After all, as Maria Sabina once lamented, the mushrooms are meant to be medicine. I learned a lot about myself from my mushroom trips, but I took away two very important insights that I could generalize about more widely. The first is the innate human need to go on a quest, a rite of passage for our ancestors, but nowadays something you mostly see in the movies. The emotional intensity, the adventure, the opportunity to delve into your mind and see what you find out about yourself. The insanely slow passage of time that makes those 6 hours seem like eons. This is why a psychedelic experience is aptly referred to as a trip. The second generalization regards the absolute beauty of the world that is right there in front of us at all times, but largely ignored. Dr. Richard Alpert, the Harvard psychologist turned psychedelic explorer, wrote a book in the 60s co-authored with Sidney Cohen, the head of the Federal Drug Commission. Alpert was to be the bad guy, espousing the positive views of psychedelics. Cohen deploring the negative effects. When they went to pick out photos for the book, the two authors couldn't agree on what a typical psychedelic drug user looked like. Cohen wanted pictures of people seeming to be wiped out, while Alpert wanted pictures of people skipping through flowers. There was only one photograph they both wanted, a picture of a guy lying on the floor looking at some spilled Coca-Cola. Cohen thought this was a good representation of how drugs waste our minds to the point where we do something so trivial and useless as staring at some soda. Alpert liked it because in that single drop of Coca-Cola abided the majesty of the universe. My next illicit drug experience took place on Halloween at a warehouse rave being DJed by some of the finest electronic musicians on the planet. I had just ingested 2 pills of pure MDMA, and the music seeped through my body and brought a euphoric smile to my face. Women, dressed as Playboy bunnies and Marilyn Monroe, had never looked so sexy, so tempting. I felt like a shark in mating season. I approached them without the slightest self-doubt. On MDMA, the simple touch of another person's finger on your forearm feels amazing. The touch of their skin, their lips as we danced under the strobe lights, was pure ecstasy. For many, this heightened sensual pleasure is all they will get from the experience. For me, it was much more profound. The waves of compassion that flooded my being would change me as a person. How silly all the neurotic tendencies and petty concerns of normal consciousness seemed in comparison to the confidence and loving friendliness that poured out of me now. I was overcome by a sense that we are all in this together, and that empathetic joy was the only reasonable response to living in a world with other people. This was the best I had ever felt, and the link between happiness and goodwill towards all was now ingrained in my brain. Well-being consists in loving and being connected with your fellow man, and having orgies with your fellow women. The following day, the bliss from the previous night was still there, but the next week I felt a bit more anxious, even a bit depressed. The drug had caused my brain to release unnatural amounts of serotonin, and I was now depleted of this precious neurotransmitter. I would not be right again until my brain had restored its natural balance. Subsequent ingestions, while still pleasant, would not produce the same magic as before. The down was no longer worth the high. And that's the problem with drugs. You always come down. I love the feeling of ecstasy, but I would need to find a way to feel it naturally, without the side effects. Could this be done? Is it possible to recreate that overwhelming sense of empathetic joy, connectedness, and self-confidence that one has on MDMA without burning out your serotonin receptors? Is it possible to capture the wonder of the universe without the risk of having a traumatically bad trip? Is it possible to view the world in a way where you are steeped in wonder, compassion, and beauty, and yet still be functional at the same time? In search of a way to retain the glow of his psychedelic experiences, Dr. Richard Alpert traveled to India. Here, he fell under the spell of a guru and changed his name to Ram Dass. Through meditation, he learned that he could have these wonderful experiences of peace and unity naturally. By training the mind, one could replicate the focus, harmony, and goodwill experienced on drugs, without ever having to come down or worry about overdosing. It was a skill first mastered by Paleolithic man. 4. Training the mind. Shamans. Chuanasawan is known as the last shaman of the Arakan people, a hunting tribe living in northern China near the border of Mongolia. As a young boy, Chuanasawan would attend the healing rituals of the shamans in his village and try to mimic their behavior. His imitations were so convincing that his elders said he might one day grow up to be a master shaman himself. It was in his blood, after all. His grandfather was a shaman, as well as his paternal uncle, a man of such great power that he was said to be able to kill a pig solely through the use of spirits. But one cannot choose to be a shaman the way one chooses to be an accountant or a lawyer. The spirits must choose you. At the age of 16, Chuanasawan's younger brother and sister died. The trauma caused Chuanasawan to become withdrawn. He would go off into the forest alone to wander aimlessly in a trance-like state. Fearing that Chuanasawan might not survive the death of his siblings, his mother took him to a distant county to visit a powerful female shaman named Wulian. Her fee for performing a healing ritual of this magnitude was a horse, but Chuanasawan's mother was too poor and didn't have a horse to give. Sensing the great potential within him, Wulian agreed to heal him anyway. The healing ritual lasted 3 nights, as Wulian danced around him, beating her drum, singing songs, and sacrificing animals to the spirits. According to Chuanasawan, one by one the spirits would enter his body, getting to know him and teaching him how to dance. As the spirits took control of him, he got up and followed Wulian around while she danced. He was at the whims of the spirits and unable to hear or speak for himself. The 3-day ritual cured him of his depression, and from that point on, he would occasionally serve as a second spirit, an essential assistant of a shaman. All went well until 3 years later he fell ill again. Although Chuanasawan interpreted the cause of his sickness to be new spirits entering his body and fighting with the spirits Wulian had put in a few years before, the truth is that he had fallen ill after another traumatic tragedy. His young wife had died from illness, and Chuanasawan yearned to be alone. For 6 months, he would sit under a tree while the spirits talked and sang to him from a distance. Finally, his mother got involved again. She enlisted the help of his uncle, Minchiswan, a shaman, to perform the healing ritual. This time, a dance of only 3 nights was not sufficient. It took 6 full days of healing rituals and the sacrifice of many animals before Chuanaswan was finally cured. His uncle introduced him to the most powerful spirit of all, that of the two-headed eagle. With the spirit eagle by his side, Chuanaswan's powers began to grow, and he was asked to perform healing rituals of his own. He would continue to heal people for the next 5 years, curing one boy of his seizures and another woman of a skin infection, without the use of any medications. Chuanaswan's path to becoming a shaman follows the typical pattern outlined in Mircea Eliade's famous work, Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy. The future shaman is usually the relative of past shamans, becomes mentally ill during his adolescent years, and is then healed and trained by an accredited shaman. The word shaman comes from the ancient religions of northern Asia and was introduced to the West when Russian forces conquered the shamanistic people in the 16th century. Since then, scholars have used the term to describe the magico-religious practices of peoples all over the world. Shamans and closely related witch doctors and medicine men are found in traditional societies ranging from the Arctic to Africa to the Amazon. It is believed that these practices date back to the Paleolithic age. While shamanism differs in many important ways across these various societies, the key that ties them together is the ability to produce a trance-like state and access to what they believe is the supernatural world of spirits. A trance is an altered state of consciousness that is characterized by focused attention, loss of awareness of the outside world, and fuller access to the unconscious mind. A trance can range from typical daydreaming to one's body going completely limp, with all access to the outside environment completely cut off. Shamans have various techniques for inducing trances, including the use of hallucinogens, but they also employ non-chemical means, such as dancing, singing, and drumming. The San Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert are known for their trance dances. The women in the tribe sit around each other in a circle, clapping together and singing. The men circle around them, taking short, pounding, rhythmic steps with full concentration. This dance will go on for up to 10 hours and requires an inhuman amount of endurance. But with each step, the Bushmen fall deeper and deeper into their trance state. In Siberia and the Arctic, shamans will use a drum that they beat rhythmically, first slowly and then picking up speed to 4 to 7 beats per second. Some scientists believe that this rhythm increases the brain's theta waves, thereby helping to induce the trance. Once in a trance, the shaman reports leaving this sphere of reality and enters the realm of benevolent and malevolent spirits. These spirits usually take the form of persons or animals with which the shaman communicates. If the spirits are evil, the shaman will call on friendly spirits to help drive them away. Or the shaman might evoke wise spirits to glean their wisdom in solving a problem afflicting the community. According to Dr. Robert Sapolsky of Stanford University, shamans today would be classified as people who have schizotypal personality disorder, a mild version of schizophrenia. While schizophrenics are often so overwhelmed by their delusions that they are unable to function in society, a schizotypal person is usually seen as someone who is eccentric but can function well enough to hold down a job, though usually one solitary in nature. The schizotypal person is drawn to odd beliefs and magical thinking. This is the person who is really excited by New Age ideas and believes in telepathy, homeopathy, or telekinesis. She will mistake ordinary life events as having an unusually profound meaning for her. Occasional quasi-psychotic episodes with intense illusions and auditory hallucinations can occur. Just as with the shaman, the onset of these psychotic episodes usually occurs after a stressful event during one's adolescence. Schizotypal is a disease with a strong genetic basis. It is curious that a gene that is so detrimental to health and could lead to such a destructive form of schizophrenia would continue to propagate itself down through the generations. After all, bouts of psychosis are rarely listed as a virtue on most respected dating websites. But back in the day, having magical abilities to commune with a supernatural realm through song and dance and cure your illness was like being a rock star, a doctor and a cult leader all rolled into one. Hence, the gene carried on, and schizotypal exists in about 2% of the population. This correlates perfectly with a tribe of 100 people having one active shaman and a shaman-to-be kinsman waiting in the wings. Shamans profess to gain wisdom to a hidden world of spirits during their trances, but we can dismiss their claims, knowing that their visions are a result of schizotypal hallucinations. The schizotypal person will experience hallucinations concordant with their society's spiritual paradigm. The shamans of the San Bushmen say that when they are in a trance, they communicate with the spirits of their dead ancestors, and these ancestors tell them where to find food and water in the desert they inhabit. The shamans of Mongolia talk to eagles and other animals, while the shamans of the Amazon communicate with the powerful spirit animals of their habitat, such as the jaguar. In the Middle Ages, Christian monks who fell into a trance after a marathon prayer session had hallucinations of angels and demons. People born in the Midwestern United States in the latter part of the 20th century routinely reported being abducted by aliens. All that said, the shamans have a lot to teach us about mental health. A group of scientists from the World Health Organization discovered something shocking. People diagnosed with schizophrenia fared better in developing nations than in advanced industrial societies. How could this be? Wouldn't access to first world doctors and medicine be more beneficial to them? The answer can be found by examining how different cultures view the disease. A person in 21st century Western society who claims to be a living god would quickly be locked up in the nearest asylum. But a schizotypal making those same claims in ancient Jerusalem might find his birthday being celebrated in distant lands thousands of years after his death. While contemporary doctors consider periods of brief psychosis as an illness, this diagnosis gives their patients the impression that something is very wrong with them. The stigma associated with mental illness causes further problems, such as anxiety and depression. Stress is a major cause of psychotic symptoms in those who have a genetic predisposition to schizophrenia, and is a contributing factor in future breakdowns. It doesn't help that most schizophrenics have trouble keeping jobs. Hearing voices while you are trying to sell someone low-risk mutual funds is not the best way to make a sale. Financial instability and social ostracism only add stress, furthering psychotic symptoms. The schizotypal who became a shaman in prehistoric times was not only given a job, but the most respected job in the community. Considered to have special powers, shamans were looked upon as Paleolithic X-Men. This must have done wonders for their self-esteem. In traditional societies, when a person succumbs to mental illness, the affliction is not attributed to something inherently wrong with the patient. The illness is due to evil spirits that have inhabited his or her body. These spirits will be driven away by a shaman during a healing ritual involving the whole community. Communal support, combined with the placebo and hypnotic effects of the trance, can help explain the healing prowess of the shamans during these rituals. Those healed by the shaman may then go on and learn to become shamans themselves. While schizophrenics today continue to relapse into psychotic episodes again and again after being treated for their initial illness, according to Eliade, those in traditional societies are essentially cured once they have undergone shaman training themselves. Sure, they may still have hallucinations. This is a genetic-based disease, after all. But their visions are now under the shaman's control. He or she can evoke these visions on command, instead of being taken over by them unwillingly. How does shaman training accomplish this? The answer to this involves physical and mental training. The shaman, says Eliad, displays a keen intelligence, a perfectly supple body, and an energy that appears unbounded. His very preparation for future work leads the neophyte to strengthen his body and perfect his intellectual qualities. In many cultures, the process of becoming a shaman required that the initiate pass through a series of ordeals. For the prospective shaman of the Shuswap tribe of British Columbia, the young man, after reaching puberty and before having ever touched a woman, would build a sweat house at some distance from the village where he would go at the end of the day, spending the night dancing and singing songs, and only being allowed to return to the village in the morning. This process might go on for several years. The Manchu in China have a ritual where the prospective shaman must pass a test in order to show mastery over his body. In the dead of winter, 9 holes are made on the ice surface of a frozen pond. The candidate has to dive into the first hole and come out through the second. Then he dives into that hole again and comes out through the third, and so on until he finally emerges for good out of the ninth hole. To perform a healing ritual, the shaman must be able to dance, drum, and chant for 10 hours straight. Try doing that 3 nights in a row, often while wearing an elaborate costume that weighs over 30 pounds. This takes an extraordinary amount of endurance, and is the reason why the shaman undergoes rigorous physical training. Recent studies have concluded that exercise has a profound effect on the emotional well-being of schizophrenics, and often results in the reduction of symptoms. The 3-day healing ritual is not only physically taxing, but mentally exhausting as well. To be able to chant continuously for such a long period of time takes a serious amount of focus. Take a break from listening and try clapping and saying Om on each clap, and keep on going for as long as you can. How long before you get bored, think this is a stupid activity, or get distracted and quit? I bet you don't last longer than a couple of minutes. Most of you will stop within 15 seconds. The shaman will begin his chanting and clapping while the sun is still up. Watch the sun dip below the horizon, and when the sun comes back up again, the shaman will still be chanting away. Both schizophrenics and schizotypals exhibit impaired attentional functioning. In fact, attention disorders are one of the best biological markers for future susceptibility to schizophrenia. Through his training, the shaman not only overcomes his attention impairment, but develops a concentration power far above that of a normal member of his tribe. That normal member, in turn, has a concentration power orders of magnitude greater than the average person in our scatterbrained society. As we will soon learn, a mastery over our ability to focus is the essential skill for developing extraordinary mental health. As a result of his training, the shaman has evolved from a state of mental illness to a high degree of mental and physical functioning. The shaman also functions as historian and keeper of the tribe's esoteric knowledge. As part of his healing practice, he must be able to recall from memory the words to songs that he sings throughout the night. Attention and memory are the building blocks of a high IQ. The end result is a person who is intelligent, energetic, and possesses great self-control. The anthropologist Karjalainen says that amongst the Yakut tribe, the shaman must be serious, possess tact, to be able to convince his neighbors. Above all, he must not be presumptuous, proud, ill-tempered. One must feel an inner force in him that does not offend, yet is conscious of its power. Through shamanism, Paleolithic man chanced upon 2 great discoveries that will be the focus of the rest of this book: that of deliberate mental training, and the role of the altered state of consciousness in producing ultimate well-being. The monks. From the beginning, Matthieu Ricard lived a charmed and stimulating life. Born in the idyllic French town of Aix-les-Bains, in the foothills of the Alps, and surrounded by the beautiful Lake Bourget, he spent his winters speeding down the slopes, his summers sailing with his uncle, a daring navigator who is one of the first to travel solo around the world on a 30-foot sailboat. Aside from skiing and sailing, Matthew's passions included wildlife photography and birding. He spent his weekends prowling through the woods searching for rare birds. At the age of 20, he published a book on migratory animals. Intellectual queries came naturally to Ricard. His father was the renowned French philosopher Jean-François Revel, and his mother a lyrical abstract expressionist painter. Matthew's interest gravitated toward science, and he eventually earned a PhD in molecular genetics while working in the lab of a Nobel Prize winner at the Pasteur Institute. It seemed as if Matthew had everything in life that he could possibly want, but at the age of 26, he dropped it all, bought a one-way ticket to the Himalayas, and never looked back. What prompted this dramatic change? By any reasonable standard, Matthew's life up until this point had been a resounding success, yet he felt that something was missing. His parents frequented rarefied intellectual and artistic circles, and he had met all the great writers, philosophers, painters, and musicians of that era. Through his uncle, he met adventurers and explorers, all in all a very interesting bunch. In a 1960s French culture that revered intellectuals, these people were thought to have attained the very pinnacle of human existence, what everyone should aspire to. But while Matthew admired the individual genius they displayed in their chosen endeavors, he realized that he had no desire to become like them. As Matthew is fond of saying, "I would love to play chess like Bobby Fischer, but I wouldn't want to be Bobby Fischer." When it came to the qualities Matthew considered the most desirable, such as altruism and joie de vivre, these high achievers were no better off than the average person. Intrigued by a documentary depicting Tibetan monks who had fled the Chinese occupation, he traveled to Darjeeling, India, to meet these people who seemed to exude such serenity. Matthew writes, "How to describe my first encounter with Kongya Rinpoche in June 1967 in a small wooden cottage a few miles from Darjeeling. He radiated inner goodness. Sitting with his back to a window that looked out over a sea of clouds, through which the majestic Himalayas rose to an altitude of more than 24,000 feet. Words are inadequate to describe the depth, serenity, and compassion that emanated from him." That encounter would change Matthew Ricard's life. From that moment on, it was only a matter of time before he would leave Paris for good and move to the Himalayas to train under the guidance of the meditation masters that he met there. For the next 35 years, Matthew would remain in the Himalayas, living in a monastery, translating ancient works into Western languages, and acting as the French interpreter for the Dalai Lama. In the late 1980s, an organization called the Mind and Life Institute began arranging dialogues between Western scientists and the Dalai Lama. The original intent of these meetings was for the scientists to acquaint the inquisitive Dalai Lama with their latest findings, but the Dalai Lama surprised them with his perspicacious inquiries regarding the current state of neuroscience. Aware that meditation brought about radical changes in subjective experience, he wanted to know if meditation could actually alter the structure of the brain. Someone proposed that the scientists examine the brains of the monks using the tools of modern science. Would the monks' claim that meditation made you happier be visible on a brain scan? A neuroscientist by the name of Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin-Madison decided to observe the brains of some high-level monks chosen by none other than the Dalai Lama himself. Davidson selected Matthew as his first test subject. By this point, Matthew had lived in the Himalayas for over 30 years, including 2.5 years of solitary retreat. He knew that on the inside, his meditation practice had done wonders for him, but could it be verified objectively? Davidson placed hundreds of electrodes on the bald monk's scalp, making him appear as if he were sporting white dreadlocks. Davidson asked Matthew to do various forms of meditation while he recorded Matthew's brainwaves with an EEG machine. Matthew also calmly meditated while in an fMRI, a place where many people refuse to go without tranquilizers. Later, Davidson compared Matthew's results with a control group that had only been practicing meditation for a week. Matthew's results were off the charts, literally. At first, the scientists figured something must have been wrong with their equipment. If they had expected the monks to be happy, they hadn't expected the monks to be this happy. The machines were incapable of reading the amount of happiness generated by Matthew. The machines would have to be recalibrated, and the experiment would have to be run again. When accurate measurements were finally assessed, the researchers were amazed. Not only were Matthew's results a complete outlier in regard to the control group, but they dwarfed anything ever reported in the scientific literature. Particularly of note was the gamma wave activity in the left prefrontal cortex. Previous research had shown that when people have high electrical activity in this area of the brain, they report feeling happiness, enthusiasm, joy, energy, and alertness. While meditating on compassion, the gamma wave activity in Matthew's brain was 30 times higher than in the control group. But it wasn't just while meditating that Matthew outshined the control group. Matthew's brain appeared more focused and happy even before he started meditating, providing evidence that meditation doesn't just make you happy while you meditate, but also carries over into the rest of your day. Richard Davidson wasn't the only scientist interested in Matthew. Paul Ekman, a world-renowned psychologist who studies the relationship between emotions and facial expressions, also wanted to study Matthew. He designed 4 studies to gauge Matthew's emotional intelligence. The first study tested Matthew's ability to accurately read other people's emotions. Ekman had devised a video that shows the image of a person's face in a particular emotion, such as contempt, anger, happiness, or sadness. Matthew would have to look at the face and tell Ekman what emotion they were experiencing. Was that contempt, or was that anger? Sound easy? Here's the rub. The images were flashed to Matthew for as little as 1/30th of a second. The images appear and disappear so quickly that your conscious mind doesn't have time to register it. Why do this? Because Ekman had found that people are really good at faking their emotions, but if you watch them closely, you can catch that quick glimpse of anger before the person recognizes it in herself and forces a smile. People who do well on Ekman's test are excellent at understanding what someone is really feeling rather than how they portray themselves as feeling. Of the more than 5,000 people that Ekman tested, Matthew and another meditator, who had himself spent over 3 years in solitary retreat, turned in the 2 best scores ever recorded. While these results were astonishing, it was the second study Ekman performed on Matthew that required him to rethink what he knew about human physiology. Hardwired into the human brain is the startle reflex. Within a fraction of a second after hearing a loud and sudden noise like an explosion, the muscles around our eyes contract automatically. We have no control over it. Even police officers that routinely shoot guns still show the startle response when they hear the sound of a pistol firing. The region of the brain in charge of the startle reflex is part of our reptilian brainstem and lies outside of our conscious control. Or so Ekman thought. What does the startle response have to do with mental well-being? Ekman had found that the magnitude of a person's startle response correlated with how often they felt negative emotions, like sadness, anger, and fear, but that there was no relationship to positive emotions. The goal of Buddhism is to decrease suffering, meaning that if Matthew's startle response was less than that of a normal person, it would provide further evidence that he experienced less negativity and that his meditation practice was working. Matthew was taken to a laboratory where he was hooked up to machines that would read his heart rate and blood pressure and videotape his facial movements. He was told that in the next 10 seconds a sound would go off. When the inevitable bang occurred, as loud as a gunshot being fired next to his ear, Matthew didn't flinch. Unlike every other human being who had ever been tested, Matthew was able to suppress the startle response in his facial muscles. He did this by going into a state of meditation called open presence, where instead of trying to actively suppress his body's reaction, he allowed the sound to happen within the vast space of his awareness, just as a bird crosses the sky but leaves no imprint on the sky itself. To this day, Ekman is still unsure how Matthew was physically able to accomplish this. Meanwhile, Dr. Richard Davidson had devised another test to measure a person's happiness by scanning their brains. When people are depressed, the amount of activity in their left prefrontal cortex is greatly diminished. And, as previously mentioned, when people experience joy, enthusiasm, and other feel-good emotions, the activity in the left prefrontal cortex spikes up. Conversely, activity in the right prefrontal cortex is associated with negative emotions, like fear and anxiety. The balance in a person's brain between activity in the left prefrontal cortex and the right prefrontal cortex is one of the key ways neuroscientists measure how happy someone is. Hook someone up to a machine and figure out the ratio between left prefrontal cortex activity and right prefrontal cortex activity, and you can get a good idea what kind of temperament they have. Davidson collected data on 175 normal individuals and measured their left prefrontal cortex to right prefrontal cortex ratio. He then brought in a monk who was the abbot of one of the major monasteries in India. He wanted to get a measurement of the monk's brain ratio, not while he was meditating, but in his baseline everyday state, to see how it would compare to the ordinary people he had measured. Once again, the results were off the charts. The monk had tipped the scales way over to the left, far higher than anyone else ever recorded. On the surface, it appeared to be indisputable that Matthew and the Tibetan abbot were a couple of jolly old fellows, but studying just two people doesn't prove much in the realm of science. Since testing Matthew, Dr. Davidson has had more than a dozen monks come through his laboratory. All of them have shown a similar cognitive profile to Matthew. Every one of these monks had spent at least 10,000 hours meditating, with the more advanced monks reaching 40,000 hours. There was also a correlation between the amount of hours the monks meditated and how happy their brains appeared to be, providing strong evidence that it was the monks' meditation training that was producing these unbelievable results. Bhante-ji. In October of 2014, I went on a meditation retreat at the Bhavana Society in the mountains of West Virginia. During the retreat, which is otherwise a silent affair, you can sign up for small group interviews with the head monk, Bhante Gunaratana Henipala, abbreviated to Bhante-ji, for obvious reasons. The purpose of these group interviews is to ask Bhante-ji questions, ostensibly related to our meditation practice. However, one woman, strawberry blonde and middle-aged, had a different concern. The monastery is located in the forest, and each night after meditating in the main meditation hall, we had to walk back to our kutis, small personal cabins, through the pitch-black night with nothing but our flashlights to guide the way. I got lost more than a few times myself amidst the trees, wondering where I was, before stumbling upon some poorly defined trail and eventually finding my way back to my kuti. Woman. Last night, I had this horrible nightmare where coyotes attacked me on the way to my kuti and just ripped my face off. And then today, while I was meditating, I was trying to focus on my breath, but the images of getting attacked by coyotes in my dreams kept popping up, and I couldn't focus. I just kept thinking about the coyotes, and now I'm scared when walking back to my kuti. I'm constantly looking out for coyotes. What should I do about this? Bhante-ji. Are you normally scared of these animals in the forest? Woman. No, I'm not usually scared of animals or the dark, but for whatever the reason, I am now. Bhante-ji. Let me tell you a story. Not that long ago, I was taking my daily walk when on the path not more than 20 feet in front of me, I saw a huge animal with a very long tail. It was a mountain lion. I did not feel any fear. I just watched it, and the cat just looked at me, and we stared at each other for a while. Finally, the cat got bored and wandered off. I continued on my walk and then turned around and took the same path on the way home. I thought to myself, I hope I see that mountain lion again. What a beautiful animal. And sure enough, there was the lion again. We stared at each other for a few minutes once more, and I just thought, what a splendid creature. I did not fear that I was going to die. The next day, I walked the same path again, and this time I came across a deer carcass that was half eaten. I realized that the mountain lion did not attack me because he was already full from eating the deer. Me. So you had no primal fear reaction? No subconscious fight-or-flight response that kicked in? Bhante G. No, I was not worried. I don't know why. Mountain lions are dangerous. I just read recently about how a mountain lion attacked a boy and his mother who were hiking in the woods. The lion pounced on the boy first, so the mother started throwing sticks and stones at the lion. The lion then turned his attention towards the mother and killed her. Another time, I was walking along and I saw two little bear cubs. I knew that the mother must be close by, and we all know that the most dangerous time to run into a bear is when it's a mother protecting her cubs. But I did not feel fear. I was curious to see the mother bear. What a beautiful creature she would be. So I just stood there until she showed up, and just like when I saw the lion, we just stared at each other until the bear walked away. Now, before I go on my walks, I always tell people where I'm going, so that if one day I am attacked by a lion or a bear, they will know where to find my body, and they don't have to go searching all over for it. That settled the issue in Bhante G's mind, and he moved on to the next question. I looked over at the woman to see if Bhante's response had calmed her. What I saw on her face instead was, "Before, I was only worried about coyotes. I didn't even know if there were coyotes in these woods. Now you're telling me there are lions and bears?" I later asked Bhante G about his own mental state, whether he had completely rid himself of suffering. No, I am not fully enlightened. Yet," he said with a smile. "There was still work to do, even at age 87. But I never worry. I never feel anger. Sometimes, as my monks know, I get irritated, but it never leads to anger. A man who never worries, not even when standing face to face with a lion. Not even when one of the engines of the commercial jet he was in burst into flames at 30,000 feet over the Pacific Ocean on the way from Hawaii to Sri Lanka. His reasoning? What would worrying accomplish at that moment? Would worrying make the fire go away? No. Better to enjoy those moments, which could well have been his last, and admire those spectacular colors produced by the flames. Positivity Challenge. When I visited the Waorani, the closest any member of the tribe came to expressing a negative emotion was a look of contemplation on a man who was recovering from a poisonous snake bite. I asked the man if the Waorani ever get angry, and he said, "Never." I asked him if he ever felt stress. He had no idea what the word meant. I asked him if the Waorani ever worried about the future. He said he didn't know what would happen in the future, but today was good. The first mind-training activity I'm going to have you do is designed to rid your mind of the pervasive negativity that is endemic to the modern world. It will be the most life-changing week of your entire life. And it begins now. For the next week, you are going to watch your mind like a hawk and observe the thoughts that surface. They will be positive, they will be negative, they will be neutral. You will have emotions, moods, and as soon as you notice any of them becoming negative, you will squash them like a bug and reframe the situation as a positive one. You are walking out of your house, feet getting soaked by the slushy snow, and your car is freezing. Good. It builds character. By putting up with the cold, you are learning to be tougher. The freezing cold is going to make you more alert. It will make you feel alive. You will use your willpower to keep yourself in good spirits. Feeling tired, Run down? Find the serenity in that. Every situation has a silver lining, and you are going to dwell on whatever that is. Why do this? The way you normally get into a bad